The Gravity of Mammon by Dan O'Shea. Chapter 1. Nick Harden never thought his first Hollywood party would be in a big-ass tent on the Chad-Sudan border, but here he was, nursing a gin and tonic, hoping he'd set things up far enough west so that he was out of RPG range in case some John Juweed punk got a bug up his ass. Fucking Mooney and his do-gooder shit. Harden had run into Jerry Mooney in Khartoum almost a year back. Dufour was heating up as the PR play of choice for socially conscious Hollywood types looking to bump up their Q scores. Harden was heading out on his usual fixer gig for one of the networks. Same gig he'd been running since he got out of the Foreign Legion back in 96. Logistics on a file footage job, camera guy, sound guy, some former BBC face with the right kind of public school accent and safari guide outfit. Get 10 or 15 minutes in the can from the hellhole of the week so Nightline's got something for a slow news day. Run the film, then cut back to the studio where the talking heads and maybe someone from Médecins Sans Frontières or some foggy bottom undersecretary could cluck their tongues between beer commercials. A little the self-flagellation that a goodly portion of the folks that actually watch Nightline like to engage in before bed helps them sleep better. Harden's job? Line up some transport and some security that when you bought them for a couple of days, stayed bought. Point the talent at the right locations, pay off the right warlords, make sure the face gets his interview without getting his throat cut, and the crew gets out without having to buy back their equipment at $10 on the dollar. The face in this case being Nigel Fox. Harden liked Nigel, and Nigel liked gin. That's why he was spending his twilight years stringing the massacre circuit when he used to cover number 10 Downing Street for BBC One. Harden had done Somalia with Nigel, Liberia back in the Taylor days, Kinshasa, Rwanda, the beginnings of a beautiful friendship. Harden waited at the Khartoum airport by the Twin Otter he'd charted as Nigel walked across the tarmac with his crew, a couple of stoner Italian adrenaline junkies, and with Jerry Mooney. Harden had heard of Mooney, of course, Hollywood's most eligible bachelor, square-jawed leading man in maybe a dozen chart-topping flicks. Probably more than a dozen, Harden figured a few had come out that hadn't made it to the Fleabag cinema down the street from his place in Accra. "Nick Harden," said Nigel. "Meet Jerry Mooney." "Jerry," said Harden, shaking hands. He turned to Nigel. "We still shooting news or are we making a movie?"
"Little of both, old boy. Ran into Jerry here at the Hilton night before last. Splendid chap. Shared a bottle of Boodles and let me have more than half. Anyway, he's heading down to Dufour for a look-see, some video blog thing for his website. Marvellously technical, beyond me, of course. But his fixer bolted on him, left the poor man stranded, all for one and one for all, of course, so I told him he could pack along with us."
"Nice of you to spend my nickel," said Harden.
"Hey, Nick," said Mooney, "look, I know I'm imposing and I know you've got to make a living. The guy I was supposed to meet up with, he said $500 a day American plus expenses. Nigel tells me we're back tomorrow night, so that's 2 days. Suppose we say $2,500, is that fair?"
Usury is what it was, but Mooney threw out the number. Mooney was starting to smell like the gravy train, with a capital G and a capital train. "Yeah, okay," said Harden. Mooney smiled, big dimpled movie star smile.
"All right, off to the heart of darkness."
Harden caught the little smirk from Nigel. They always do that, the first-timers. Drop the Conrad on you. But the darkness wasn't concentrated in a heart anywhere. It had metastasized into hundreds of tumors. Some, like Dufour, were 1,000 miles wide, but most of them were about the size of a cot-chewing 13-year-old with an AK-47. Nigel waved the Italians back to the truck.
"You forgot the bloody gin!"
So Mooney gets the Dufour bug bad. Started harping on congressmen, hanging out with Martin Sheen the whole nine yards. Mooney's buddies start turning up, and Harden ends up with damn near a full-time gig as Dufour tour guide to the stars. And the stars pay way better than the networks. Then Mooney gets his big idea. Dollars for Dufour. A Live Aid-type deal, but right here on site. Mooney signed up half a dozen big-name bands, got a mess of Hollywood types to commit huge buzz in the media. Harden had to admit it made sense from Mooney's perspective. For once, the press would have more cameras looking at Dufour than they had looking up Paris Hilton's skirt. But from Harden's perspective, it was a nightmare. Staging a rock concert on the Dufour border was like building a golf course in Antarctica. Harden paid the bribes, pulled the strings, got the generators and tents and food and booze shipped in, and he did the other stuff he couldn't tell Mooney about. Like talking to his contact at the Chinese embassy in Khartoum,
explaining how, while this liberal love fest is likely to piss off the masters in Beijing no end, it's still in the PRC's best interest to lean on the Sudanese and make sure they keep the Janjaweed on their leash for a few weeks. Suddenly you've got almost as many publicists in Darfur as you've got starving people, and they're making sure every A-list name in town for the show has a camera on them every second. Janjaweed goes on a rampage within a light year of this place, and the PRC is going to have to deal with gang rapes and mass murder live and covered for more camera angles than a Super Bowl. And Harden was 24 hours from pulling it off. The night before the big show, Harden was standing in the corner of the party tent sipping a gin and tonic with actual ice in it and watching all the size one blondes strut around. Drink tasted good, which it should, because when you built in the logistics, it probably cost more per ounce than cocaine. The tent was full of movie stars, rock stars, a couple of the right kind of politicians, handful of network news guys, not the second string talent that usually got shunted off to Africa either. Couple of print guys, but only the big names with hot blogs and book deals. The rest of the print media was outside with the other refugees and the aid workers. Now Seamus Fenn was working on fucking up Harden's payday. Fenn had the Hollywood radical gene bad, always ready to play footsie with anyone who wanted to badmouth the U.S., but he also had an alpha male problem. Had to know more and be a badder ass than anyone around. When he got off the chopper that morning with What's-Her-Face, some actress Harden still couldn't quite place, he was in full macho mode. Chopper had spooked a mole viper out of its hole, the snake scurrying off for cover. Actress chick evidently had a snake problem because she screamed, so Fenn had to get all manly, make a move to grab the snake. "I'd leave that alone," said Harden. "Poisonous." "That little worm," said Fenn. "Mole vipers don't look like much. Short little black things, harmless if you don't fuck with them." Fenn started walking after the snake. When his shadow fell over it, the snake stopped crawling and coiled up. Last thing Harden needed was Fenn getting himself bit on his watch, so Harden shot the snake. "The fuck you do that for? I just wanted to get a look at it," Fenn said, puffing up. "They coil like that, they're gonna strike. I doubt if we have any anti-venom here. You might have survived the chopper ride out, but you definitely would have missed the party." The actress was over her snake phobia now that it was dead, and also didn't want her screaming fit as the last image in the minds of the press guys had gotten off the chopper with them. "Seamus, we've come to help save Africa, not to help destroy it," she said, stomping off. A minute ago, Fenn was halfway into her pants. Now she's marching over to Mooney. Fenn walked over to Harden. Harden was 5'9", about 175 pounds. Fenn had 4 inches and 20 pounds on him. Fenn got in real close. "I don't know who you are, cowboy, but I don't like you already." Mooney broke things up. "Seamus, this is Nick Harden. You haven't been out here before, you'd know him. He was just looking out for you." "Yeah, I've looked out for myself in worse places than this. I'm not afraid of some piss-ant snake," said Fenn. "Of course not," said Mooney. "Come on, let's get you settled in, get you up to speed on the program." Mooney got an arm around Fenn's shoulders, turned him away from Harden, walked him off. Within 2 hours, the story of Seamus Fenn's arrival in Darfur was up on one of the press blogs, complete with video, and nobody was missing a chance to put the needle in with Fenn. And now Fenn was stalking Harden around the party. Fenn was liquored up. He'd been hitting it hard for a couple of hours. Every time he saw Harden, he'd start angling toward him, but Harden would move off, and somebody would grab Fenn and start chatting him up. Then Harden lost his concentration. The actress from the snake scene earlier came over. Been at the booze herself some, wanted to apologize for the whole scene, hitting on Harden pretty hard, making it clear that if he wanted to stop by her trailer after the party, she'd be waiting. And Harden was definitely thinking about it. You get up in your 40s, you don't have a lot of hard-body 20-somethings throwing themselves at you. And getting laid was one of the downsides of an Africa career nowadays. Condoms or not, with the AIDS rate, you had to think real hard before you dipped your wick anywhere. So this chick is stroking his arm, leaning forward so that her loose and not very buttoned blouse kept falling open, and Harden had his mind on something other than Fenn long enough for Fenn to get right up next to him. "You a star fucker, Harden? That's your deal?" Harden turned, and Fenn was right behind him, face red, smelling of Bombay and testosterone. "I was just thanking Mr. Harden for saving your life earlier, Seamus," said the girl, putting some real bite into it, and all of a sudden Harden got it. Some kind of history between these two, and she'd come over here to tee Harden up, get Fenn over, make some scene, get some more FaceTime on YouTube. Harden thinking how his pecker could still get him in trouble. Which was when Fenn threw the right. Shitty right, movie right, big, long, looping, telegraphed punch Harden could have slipped twice. But Harden stood in, just turning with it at the last minute, let a glance off his head, made a show of going down. "Whoa, nice shot," Harden said from his knees, showing his ass, still looking for an out. "Look, I guess I had that coming, okay? Just let me get out of here." But when Fenn went to put the boot in while Harden was getting up, Harden lost it. He grabbed the leg, flipped Fenn over onto the bar table, and gave him a good right to the nose. Just one, but the right kind. Straight, short, starting from the legs, hips turning with it. Fenn's nose got way broken, and pieces of the highball glass he landed on ended up stuck in his back. "Oh, Seamus!" The blonde, all concerned now, leaning over the semi-conscious actor. "Better get him to the dock," said Harden, trying to pull her aside so he could get a look. She reared up and slapped him hard across the face. "Get your hands off me, you thug! This whole continent is full of thugs!" She stomped off, exactly the same carriage as earlier after the snake. Her exit stomp, Harden figured. She must have that one down. That derailed the gravy train right there. Mooney kept him on through the concert, and he was cool about it afterwards. "Everyone knows Fenn's an ass, especially when he drinks," said Mooney. "But the Darfur story's bigger than us," said Mooney. "Can't afford to let it be about some movie star brawl," said Mooney. "Need to let you go and get you and Fenn off the front page, make this about the people again," said Mooney. "You'll always be a hero of mine," said Mooney. "Here's another $10,000. Harden knew there was more to it. The whole Hollywood PR machine was cranked up around dollars for Dufour, their chance to prove what a big heart the industry had, take everyone's mind off the brainless crap they put out, the no-panty starlets and the revolving doors at the rehab clinics. And now instead of Dufour leading the news, they had a video of a drunk actor acting like, well, a drunk actor. Harden tried to get back into the network gigs, but suddenly no one returned his calls. After a couple of months, he ran into a producer he went back with a ways, and the guy told him he'd been blackballed. Word had gone out from the agents and PR flacks. Any news team working with Harden gets zero play with their people. And the same media conglomerates that own the movie studios own the news networks. The movie studios made way more money. Harden figured he'd had a good run in Africa, but he was pushing 50, and after almost 20 years schlepping around the Sahel, 50 was pushing back. It was time for an exit strategy, and he had one. Harden hadn't always been a glorified gopher. He'd spent 8 years in the Marines, scout sniper back in Gulf War I, and when a beef back home meant he needed a get-out-of-jail-free card, he spent another decade in the French Foreign Legion, 1st Koi, 2nd Para Regiment, pretty much the baddest asses in a badass crowd. Harden always had a couple story ideas brewing so he'd have something for the networks when they called. Before he'd gotten detoured into the first shit, he'd been looking into the old West African blood diamond business. Cooled off after Charles Taylor and his RUF animals finally got run to ground, but there'd always been a Lebanese connection to diamond trade in West Africa, and Harman heard that Hezbollah had muscled in on that, and then bin Laden and the boys had muscled in on Hezbollah, and now Al-Qaeda was using diamonds as a way to move capital sub rosa since the U.S. was putting the freeze on any above-ground cash flow. So Harden had done a little recon, and what he found out was that sometimes their security wasn't what it ought to be. And that's how Harden ended up on the Air France flight to Chicago with 18 ounces of uncut stones hidden in his bag. Time to talk to Stein.